30 de Shiva.
44.
68. Hero loses Raven a few miles outside of downtown, but it doesn't matter by this point. He goes straight to the plaza and then starts to orbit the rim of the amphitheater at high speed, a one-man picket fence. Raven makes his approach within a few seconds. Hero breaks out of his orbit and heads straight for him, and they come together like a couple of medieval jousters. Hero loses his left arm, and Raven drops a leg. The limbs topple to the ground. Hero drops his katana and uses his remaining arm to draw his one-handed sword, a better match for Raven's long knife anyway. He cuts Raven off just as he's about to plummet over the lip of the amphitheater and forces him aside. Raven's momentum takes him half a mile away in half a second. Hero chases him down by following a series of educated guesses. He knows this territory like Raven knows the currents of the Aleutians. And then they are blasting through the narrow streets of the Metaverse's financial district, waving long knives at each other, slicing and dicing hundreds of pinstriped avatars who happen to get in their way. But they never seem to hit each other. The speeds are just too great. The target's too small. Hero's been lucky so far. He has got Raven caught up in the thrill of competition, made him spoil for a fight. But Raven doesn't need this. He can get back to the amphitheater pretty easily without bothering to kill Hero first. And finally, he realizes it. He sheathes his knife and dives into an alley between skyscrapers. Hero follows him, but by the time he's gotten into that same alley, Raven's gone. Hero goes over the lip of the amphitheater doing a couple of hundred miles per hour and soars out into space in free fall above the heads of a quarter of a million wildly cheering hackers. They all know Hero. He's the guy with the swords. He's a friend of David's. And as his own personal contribution to the benefit, he's apparently decided to stage a sword fight with some kind of hulking, scary-looking demon on a motorcycle. Don't touch that dial. It's going to be a hell of a show. He lands on the stage and bounces to a halt next to his motorcycle. The bike still works, but it's worthless down here. Raven is 10 meters away, grinning at him. Bombs away, Raven says. He pulls the glowing blue lozenge out of his sidecar with one hand and drops it on the center of the amphitheater. It breaks open like the shell of an egg and light shines out of it. The light begins to grow and take shape. The crowd goes wild. Hero runs toward the egg. Raven cuts him off. Raven can't move around on his feet now because he's lost a leg. But he can still control the bike. He's got his long knife out now, and the two blades come together above the egg, which has become the vortex of a blinding, deafening tornado of light and sound. Colored shapes, foreshortened by their immense speed, shoot from the center of it and take positions above their heads, building a three-dimensional picture. The hackers are going nuts. Hero knows that the hacker quadrant in the Black Sun is at this moment emptying itself out. They are all cramming through the exit and running down the street toward the plaza, coming to see Hero's fantastic show of light, sound, swords, and sorcery. Raven tries to shove Hero back. It would work in reality because Raven has such overpowering strength. But avatars are equally strong unless you hack them up in just the right way. So Raven gives a mighty push and then pulls his knife back so that he can take a cut at Hero's neck when Hero flies away from him. But Hero doesn't fly away. He waits for the opening and then takes Raven's sword hand off. Then, just in case, he takes Raven's other hand off. The crowd screams in delight. How do I stop this thing? Hero says. Beats me. I just deliver them, Raven says. Do you have any concept of what you just did? Yeah. Realized my lifelong ambition, Raven says, a huge relaxed grin spreading across his face. I nuked America. Hero cuts his head off. The crowd of doomed hackers rises to its feet and shrieks. Then they go silent as Hero abruptly disappears. he has switched over to a small invisible avatar. He is hovering in the air now above the shattered remains of the egg. Gravity takes him right down into the center of it. As he falls, he is muttering to himself, "Snow scan." It's the piece of software he wrote while he was killing time on the life raft. The one that searches for Snow Crash. With hero protagonist seemingly gone from the stage, the hackers turn their attention toward the giant construction rising up out of the egg. All that nonsense with the sword fight must have been just a wacky introductory piece. Hero's typically offbeat way of getting their attention. This light and sound show is the main attraction. The amphitheater is now filling up rapidly as thousands of hackers pour in from all over the place, running down the street from the black sun, streaming out of the big office towers where the major software corporations are headquartered, goggling into the metaverse from all points in reality as word of the extravaganza spreads down the fiber optic grapevine at the speed of light. The light show is designed as if latecomers were anticipated. It builds to false climax after false climax, like an expensive fireworks show, and each one is better. It is so vast and complicated that no one sees more than 10% of it. You could spend a year watching it over and over again and keep seeing new things. It is a mile-high structure of moving two- and three-dimensional images, interlocked in space and time. It's got everything in it. Leni Riefenstahl films, the sculptures of Michelangelo, and the fictional inventions of Da Vinci made real. World War II dogfights zooming in and out of the middle, veering out over the crowd, shooting and burning and exploding. Scenes from 1,000 classic films flowing and merging together in a single vast complicated story. But in time, it begins to simplify itself and narrow into a single bright column of light. By this point, it is the music that is carrying the show. A pounding bass beat and a deep threatening ostinato that tells everyone to keep watching. The best is yet to come. And everyone does watch, religiously. The column of light begins to flow up and down and resolve itself into a human form. Actually, it is four human forms. Female nudes standing shoulder to shoulder, facing outward like caryatids. Each of them is carrying something long and slender in her hands. A pair of tubes. 250,000 hackers stare at the women, towering above the stage, as they raise their arms above their heads and unroll the four scrolls, turning each one of them into a flat television screen the size of a football field. From the seats in the amphitheater, the screens virtually blot out the sky. They are all that anyone can see. The screens are blank at first, but finally, the same image snaps into existence on all four of them at once. It is an image consisting of words. It says, "If this were a virus, you would be dead now. Fortunately, it's not. The metaverse is a dangerous place. How's your security? Call Hero Protagonist Security Associates for a free initial consultation." This is exactly the kind of high-tech nonsense that never, ever worked when we tried it in Vietnam, Uncle Enzo says. Your point is well taken. But technology has come a long way since then, says Kai, the surveillance man from Ing Security Industries. Kai is talking to Uncle Enzo over a radio headset. His van, full of electronic gear, is lurking a quarter of a mile away in the shadows, next to an LAX cargo warehouse. "I am monitoring the entire airport and all its approaches with a three-dimensional metaverse display. For example, I know that your dog tags, which you customarily wear around your neck, are missing. I know that you are carrying one Kong buck and 85 Kong pence in change in your left pocket. I know that you have a straight razor in your other pocket. Looks like a nice one, too." "Never underestimate the importance of good grooming," Uncle Enzo says. But I do not understand why you are carrying a skateboard.
It's a replacement for the one YT lost in front of EBGOC, Uncle Enzo says. It's a long story.
Sir, we have a report from one of our franchulates,
says a young lieutenant in a Mafia windbreaker, jogging across the apron with a black walkie-talkie in one hand. He is not really a lieutenant. The Mafia is not very keen on the use of military ranks, but for some reason, Uncle Enzo thinks of him as the lieutenant.
The second chopper set down in a strip mall parking lot about 10 miles from here and met the pizza car and picked up Rife, then took off again. They are on their way in now.
Send someone out to pick up the abandoned pizza car and give the driver a day off,
Uncle Enzo says. The lieutenant looks somewhat taken aback that Uncle Enzo is concerning himself with such a tiny detail. It is as if the Don were going up and down highways picking up litter or something. But he nods respectfully, having just learned something. Details matter. He turns away and begins talking into his radio. Uncle Enzo has serious doubts about this fellow. He is a blazer person, adept at running the small-time bureaucracy of a Nova Sicilia franchulate, but lacking in the kind of flexibility that, for example, YT has. A classic case of what is wrong with the Mafia today. The only reason the lieutenant is even here is because the situation has been changing so rapidly, and of course, because of all the fine men they lost in the Kowloon. Kai comes in over the radio again. YT has just contacted her mother and asked for a ride, he says. Would you like to hear their conversation?
Not unless it has tactical significance,
Uncle Enzo says briskly. This is one more thing to check off his list. He has been worried about YT's relationship with her mother and was meaning to speak with her about it. Rife's jet sits on the tarmac, engines idling, waiting to taxi out into the runway. In the cockpit are a pilot and co-pilot. Until half an hour ago, they were loyal employees of L. Bob Rife. Then they sat and watched out the windshield as the dozen Rife security drones who were stationed around the hangar variously got their heads blown off, their throats slit, or else just plain dropped their weapons and fell to their knees and surrendered. Now the pilot and co-pilot have taken lifelong oaths of loyalty to Uncle Enzo's organization. Uncle Enzo could have just dragged them out and replaced them with his own pilots, but this way is better. If Rife should somehow actually make it onto the plane, he will recognize his own pilots and think that everything is fine. And the fact that the pilots are alone there in the cockpit, without any direct Mafia supervision, will merely emphasize the great trust that Uncle Enzo has placed in them and the oath that they have taken. It will actually enhance their sense of duty. It will amplify Uncle Enzo's displeasure if they should break their oaths. Uncle Enzo has no doubts about the pilots at all. He is less happy with the arrangements here, which were made rather hastily. The problem is, as usual, the unpredictable YT. He was not expecting her to jump out of a moving helicopter and get free from L. Bob Rife. He was, in other words, expecting a hostage negotiation somewhat later on, after Rife had flown YT back to his headquarters in Houston. But the hostage situation no longer obtains, and so Uncle Enzo feels it is important to stop Rife now, before he gets back to his home turf in Houston. He has called for a major realignment of Mafia forces, and right now, dozens of helicopters and tactical units are hastily replotting their courses and trying to converge on LAX as quickly as they can. But in the meantime, Enzo is here with a small number of his own personal bodyguards and this technical surveillance man from Ng's organization. They have shut down the airport. This was easy to do. They just pulled Lincoln Town cars onto all the runways, for starters, and then went into the control tower and announced that in a few minutes they would be going to war. Now, LAX is probably quieter than it has been at any point since it was built. Uncle Enzo can actually hear the faint crashing of surf on the beach half a mile away. It is almost pleasant here. Weenie roasting weather. Uncle Enzo is cooperating with Mr. Lee, which means working with Ng. And Ng, while highly competent, has a technological bias that Uncle Enzo distrusts.
he would prefer a single good soldier in polished shoes, armed with a 9, to 100 of Ing's gizmos and portable radar units. When they came out here, he was expecting a broad open space in which to confront Rife. Instead, the environment is cluttered. Several dozen corporate jets and helicopters are parked on the apron. Nearby is an assortment of private hangars, each with its own fenced-in parking area, containing a number of cars and utility vehicles. And they are rather close to the tank farm, where the airport supply of jet fuel is stored. That means lots of pipes and pumping stations and hydraulic falderall sprouting out of the ground. Tactically, the area has more in common with a jungle than with a desert. The apron and runway themselves are, of course, more desert-like, although they have drainage ditches where any number of men could be concealed. So a better analogy would be beach warfare in Vietnam, a broad open area that abruptly turns into a jungle, not Uncle Enzo's favorite place. "The chopper is approaching the perimeter of the airport," Kai says. Uncle Enzo turns to his lieutenant.
"Everyone in place?"
"Yes, sir."
"How do you know that?"
"They all checked in a few minutes ago."
"That means absolutely nothing. And how about the pizza car?"
"Well, I thought I would do that later, sir."
"You need to be capable of doing more than one thing at a time."
The lieutenant turns away, shamed and awed.
"Kai," Uncle Enzo says, "anything interesting happening on our perimeter?"
"Nothing at all," Kai says.
"Anything uninteresting?"
"A few maintenance workers, as normal."
"How do you know they are maintenance workers and not Rife soldiers in costume? Did you check their IDs?"
"Soldiers carry guns, or at least knives. Radar shows that these men do not. QED."
"Still trying to get all our men to check in," the lieutenant says. "Having a little radio trouble, I guess."
Uncle Enzo puts one arm around the lieutenant's shoulders.
"Let me tell you a story, son. From the first moment I saw you, I thought you seemed familiar. Finally, I realized that you remind me of someone I used to know. A lieutenant who was my commanding officer for a while in Vietnam."
The lieutenant is thrilled.
"Really?" "Yes. He was young, bright, ambitious, well-educated, and well-meaning. But he had certain deficiencies. He had a stubborn inability to grasp the fundamentals of our situation over there. A sort of mental block, if you will, that caused those of us who were serving under him to experience the most intense kind of frustration. It was touch and go for a while, son. I don't mind telling you that."
"How did it work out, Uncle Enzo?"
"It worked out fine. You see, one day, I took it upon myself to shoot him in the back of the head."
The lieutenant's eyes get very big, and his face seems paralyzed. Uncle Enzo has no sympathy for him at all. If he screws this up, people could die. Some new piece of radio babble comes in over the lieutenant's headset.
"Oh, Uncle Enzo?"
he says, very quietly and reluctantly.
"Yes? You were asking about that pizza car?"
"Yes."
"It's not there."
"Not there.
Apparently, when they sat down to pick up Rife, a man got out of the chopper and climbed into the pizza car and drove it away."
"Where did he drive it to?"
"We don't know, sir. We only had one spotter in the area, and he was tracking Rife."
"Take off your headset," Uncle Enzo says, "and turn off that walkie-talkie. You need your ears."
"My ears?"
Uncle Enzo drops into a crouch and walks briskly across the pavement until he's between a couple of small jets. He sets the skateboard down quietly. Then he unties his shoelaces and pulls his shoes off. He takes his socks off, too, and stuffs them into the shoes. He takes the straight razor out of his pocket, flips it open, and slits both of his trouser legs from the hem up to his groin. Then bunches the material up and cuts it off. Otherwise, the fabric will slide over his hairy legs when he walks and make noise.
"My God!" the lieutenant says a couple of planes over. "Al is down! My God, he's dead!"
Amala quince pantam gal nunca ria.
55.
70. Uncle Enzo leaves his jacket on for now because it's dark and because it's lined with satin so that it's relatively quiet. Then he climbs up onto the wing of one of the planes so that his legs cannot be seen by someone crouching on the ground. He hunkers down on the end of the wing, opens his mouth so that he can hear better, and listens. The only thing he can hear at first is an uneven spattering noise that wasn't there before, like water falling out of a half-open faucet onto bare pavement. The sound seems to be coming from a nearby airplane. Uncle Enzo is afraid that it may be jet fuel leaking onto the ground as part of a scheme to blow up this whole section of the airport and take out all opposition at a stroke. He drops silently to the ground, makes his way carefully around a couple of adjacent planes, stopping every few feet to listen, and finally sees it. One of his soldiers has been pinned to the aluminum fuselage of a Learjet by means of a long wooden pole. Blood runs out of the wound, down his pant legs, drips from his shoes, and spatters onto the tarmac. From behind him, Uncle Enzo hears a brief scream that suddenly turns into a sharp, gaseous exhalation. He has heard it before. It is a man having a sharp knife drawn across his throat. It is undoubtedly the lieutenant. He has a few seconds to move freely now. He doesn't even know what he's up against, and he needs to know that. So he runs in the direction the screen came from, moving quickly from cover of one jet to the next, staying down in a crouch. He sees a pair of legs moving on the opposite side of a jet's fuselage. Uncle Enzo is near the tip of the jet's wing. He puts both hands on it, shoves down with all his weight, and then lets go. It works. The jet rocks toward him on its suspension. The assassin thinks that Uncle Enzo has just jumped up onto the wingtip, so he climbs up onto the opposite wing and waits with his back to the fuselage, waiting to ambush Enzo when he climbs over the top. But Enzo is still on the ground. He runs in toward the fuselage on silent bare feet, ducks beneath it, and comes up from underneath with his straight razor in one hand. The assassin, Raven, is right where Enzo expected him. But Raven is already getting suspicious. He stands up to look over the top of the fuselage, and that puts his throat out of reach. Enzo's looking at his legs instead. It's better to be conservative and take what you can get than take a big gamble and blow it. So Enzo reaches in, even as Raven is looking down at him, and severs Raven's left Achilles tendon. As he's turning away to protect himself, something hits him very hard in the chest. Uncle Enzo looks down and is astonished to see a transparent object protruding from the right side of his ribcage. Then he looks up to see Raven's face 3 inches from his. Uncle Enzo steps back away from the wing. Raven was hoping to fall on top of him, but instead tumbles to the ground. Enzo steps back in, reaching forward with his razor. But Raven, sitting on the tarmac, has already drawn a second knife. He lunges for the inside of Uncle Enzo's thigh and does some damage. Enzo sidesteps away from the blade, throwing off his attack, and ends up making a short but deep cut on the top of Raven's shoulder. Raven knocks his arm aside before Enzo can go for the throat again. Uncle Enzo's hurt, and Raven's hurt. But Raven can't outrun him anymore. It's time to take stock of things a little bit. Enzo runs away, though when he moves, terrible pains run up and down the right side of his body. Something thuds into his back, too. He feels a sharp pain above one kidney, but only for a moment. He turns around to see a bloody piece of glass shattering on the pavement. Raven must have thrown it into his back, but without Raven's arm strength behind it. It didn't have enough momentum to penetrate all the way through the bulletproof fabric, and it fell out. Glass knives. No wonder Kai didn't see him on millimeter wave. By the time he gets behind the cover of another plane, his sense of hearing is being overwhelmed by the approach of a chopper.
It is Rife's chopper, settling down on the tarmac a few dozen meters away from the jet. The thunder of the rotor blades and the blast of the wind seem to penetrate into Uncle Enzo's brain. He closes his eyes against the wind and utterly loses his balance, has no idea where he is until he slams full length into the pavement. The pavement beneath him is slippery and warm, and Uncle Enzo realizes that he is losing a great deal of blood. Staring across the tarmac, he sees Raven making his way toward the aircraft, limping horrendously, one leg virtually useless. Finally, he just gives up on it and just hops on his good leg. Rife has climbed down out of the chopper. Raven and Rife are talking, Raven gesticulating back in Enzo's direction. Then Rife nods his approval, and Raven turns around, his teeth bright and white. He's not grimacing so much as he is smiling in anticipation. He begins to hop toward Uncle Enzo, pulling another glass knife out of his jacket. The bastard is carrying a million of those things. He's coming after Enzo, and Enzo can't even stand up without passing out. He looks around and sees nothing but a skateboard and a pair of expensive shoes and socks about 20 feet away. He can't stand up, but he can do the GI crawl. And so he begins to pull himself forward on his elbows, even as Raven is hopping toward him one-legged. They meet in an open lane between two adjacent jets. Enzo is on his belly, slumped over the skateboard. Raven is standing, supporting himself with one hand on the wing of the jet, the glass knife glittering in his other hand. Enzo is now seeing the world in dim black and white, like a cheap metaverse terminal. This is how his buddies used to describe it in Vietnam, right before they succumbed to blood loss. "Hope you've done your last rites," Raven says, "because there ain't no time to call a priest."
"There is no need for one," Uncle Enzo says,
and punches the button on the skateboard labeled RATA-KS Narrow Cone Tuned Shockwave Projector. The concussion nearly blows his head off. Uncle Enzo, if he survives, will never hear well again. But it does wake him up a little bit. He lifts his head off the board to see Raven standing there stunned, empty-handed, 1,000 tiny splinters of broken glass raining down out of his jacket. Uncle Enzo rolls over on his back and waves a straight razor in the air.
"I prefer steel myself," he says. "Would you like a shave?"
'71. Rife sees it all and understands it clearly enough. He would love to see how it all comes out, but he's a very busy man. He would like to get out of here before the rest of the Mafia and Ing and Mr. Lee and all those other assholes come after him with their heat-seeking missiles. And there's no time to wait for the gimpy Raven to hop all the way back. He gives a thumbs up to the pilot and begins climbing the steps into his private jet. It's daytime. A wall of billowing orange flame grows up silently from the tank farm a mile away, like a time-lapse chrysanthemum. It is so vast and complicated in its blooming, uncontrolled growth that Rife stops halfway up the stairs to watch. A powerful disturbance is moving through the flame, leaving a linear trail in the light, like a cosmic ray fired through a cloud chamber. By the force of its passage, it leaves behind a shock wave that is clearly visible in the flame, a bright spreading cone that is 100 times larger than the dark source at its apex, a black bullet-like thing, supported on four legs that are churning too fast to be visible. It is so small and so fast that L. Bob Rife would not be able to see it if it were not headed directly for him. It is picking its way over a broad tangle of open-air plumbing, the pipes that carry the fuel to the jets, jumping over some obstacles, digging its metallic claws into others, tearing them open with the explosive thrust of its legs, igniting their contents with the sparks that fly whenever its feet touch the pavement. It gathers its four legs under it, leaps 100 feet to the top of a buried tank, uses that as a launch pad for another long arcing leap over the chain link fence that separates the fuel installation from the airport proper, and then it settles into a long, steady, powerful lope,
accelerating across the perfect geometric plane of the runway, chased by a long tongue of flame that extends lazily from the middle of the conflagration, whirling inward upon itself as it traces the currents in the Rat Thing's aftershock. Something tells L. Bob Reif to get away from the jet, which is loaded with fuel. He turns and half jumps, half falls off the stairs, moving clumsily because he's looking at the Rat Thing, not at the ground. The Rat Thing, just a tiny dark thing close to the ground, visible only by virtue of its shadow against the flames and by the chain of white sparks where its claws dig into the pavement, makes a tiny correction in its course. It's not headed for the jet. It's headed for him. Reif changes his mind and runs up the stairway, taking the steps three at a time. The stairway flexes and recoils under his weight, reminding him of the jet's fragility. The pilot has seen it coming, doesn't wait to retract the stairway before he releases the brakes, and sends the jet taxiing down the runway, swinging the nose away from the Rat Thing. He punches the throttles, nearly throwing the jet onto one wing as it whips around in a tight curve and redlines the engines as soon as he sees the center line of the runway. Now they can only see forward and sideways. They can't see what is chasing them. YT is the only person who can see it happen. Having easily penetrated airport security with a courier pass, she is coasting onto the apron near the cargo terminal. From here, she has an excellent view across half a mile of open runway, and she sees it all happen. The plane roars down the runway, hauling its door closed as it goes, shooting pale blue flames at its engine nozzles, trying to build up speed for takeoff, and Fido chases it down like a dog going after a fat mailman, makes one final tremendous leap into the air, and, turning himself into a Sidewinder missile, flies nose-first into the tailpipe of its left engine. The jet explodes about 10 feet off the ground, catching Fido and L. Bob Reif and his virus all together in its fine, sterilizing flame.
How sweet!
She stays for a while and watches the aftermath. Mafia choppers coming in, doctors jumping out with doc boxes and blood bags and stretchers. Mafia soldiers scurrying between the private jets, apparently looking for someone. A pizza delivery car takes off from one of the parking areas, tires squealing, and a mafia car peels out after it in hot pursuit. But after a while it gets boring, so she skates back to the main terminal, under her own power mostly, though she manages to poon a fuel tanker for a while. Mom's waiting for her, in her stupid little jelly bean car, by the United Baggage Claim, just like they arranged on the phone. YT opens the door, throws her plank into the back seat, and climbs in.
Home? Mom says.
Yeah. Home seems about right.
43. This has been a Time Warner Audiobooks production of Snow Crash, written by Neal Stephenson and read by Jonathan Davis. Executive producer Maya Thomas. Produced and directed by Kevin Thompson. Production coordinated by Dennis Kao. Available in bookstores everywhere.